The BBC presents My Word. And here to introduce the program and the panel is Jack Longland.
My Word is a word game played by people whose business is words, and those taking part are Dilys Powell, Frank Muir, Anne Scott James, and Dennis Norton. Here's round one to test their vocabulary. 2 marks if they get the meaning of these words reasonably right. We begin with Dilys Powell. Dilys, what's the meaning of the word indigent?
Indigent?
Indigent.
Means poverty-stricken, poor. Yeah.
Poor, needy, lacking the necessities of life. 2 marks it is. Dennis Norton, the meaning of bally rag or bully rag?
Bally rag is it's sort of hijinks at Covent Garden. It's there are a lot of madcap tomboys around there. bally rag, it's kind of frivolity peculiar to ballet company.
I think you've got that. It means to maltreat by jeering or playing practical jokes or hustling or horseplay or anything you like. Bally rag probably came first, and bully rag was making it more easily understandable, I suppose. Anne Scott James, what is a spurrier?
Well, he's someone who rhymes with a furrier.
Yes.
Spurious furrier.
A spurious furrier, yes.
Sells, you know, rabbit as mink.
Well, he's one of those useful people who makes that everyday commodity, spurs.
We all use so much in daily life. You're absolutely right. A spurrier is a man who makes spurs, or a spur maker. 2 marks. Frank Muir, yours is much harder. What is a staggard, or it can be a staggart?
It's a very good word.
S-T-A-G-G-A-R-D.
S-T-A-G-G, isn't it? Not one G.
No.
G-G-A-R-D, staggard. Could be a boozy blackguard.
Staggart?
So one who staggards.
Had drunk his fill.
Drunk his fill?
Drunk his fill.
What,
At Eve.
That's the stag at bay.
Yes.
In rutting season. A staggard is a blackguard stag who has drunk his fill. Cheers.
Well, half a mark for accepting the clue. A staggard, and it's a fairly ancient word, is a stag which is 4 years old. Now, before we start round two, I give each team a quotation from to write down, and I want the two women members of the team to go on studying their quotations, because at the end of the program, I shall ask them where the quotations come from. And Dilys Powell and Frank Muir, here's yours. The dawn comes up like thunder. And Anne Scott James and Dennis, yours is, where there's a will, there's a way. And then at the end of the program, I shall ask Frank and Dennis to give me their ideas of how these came to be said or written. Round two is legends and mythology. 2 marks for correct answers. Dilys Powell, what in Greek mythology, or who if you prefer it, were the Erinyes? E-R-I-N-Y-E-S. Erinyes.
They were the kind of disagreeable fates.
Mm-hmm. What'd they do?
Oh, well, they they sort of hunted you down.
Why?
If you'd done wrong.
Yes.
They hunted Orestes down.
They did very much so, yes. These were the goddesses of vengeance, and they were hideous. And they avenged people who'd been done down, particularly those criminals who'd violated the laws of society or the natural law against filial duty or hospitality, committing murder or perjury or so on. And they pursued you even if it wasn't really your fault that you committed the crime. People like, as Dilys said, Orestes or Oedipus, who'd committed crimes without knowing what he was doing. But it was an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Dennis Norton, we all know about the story of Androcles, or Androclus, and the lion, but in the end, what happened to Androcles, and what became of the lion?
That was very interesting, actually. Androcles met this lion in the forest. He took the thorn out of his foot.
Yes.
And the lion was suitably grateful, and then sometime later, Androcles was sent into this arena, and this lion padded towards him and Androcles gave a great cry and said, "You remember me?" And the lion leapt and ate him. But it was an entirely different one. What happened to him in the end? He ended up as a rug.
Alter the ending of your story. I'll give you two marks. This is the rather sick version you've given us.
Yes. No, actually, the lion incredibly refused to destroy Androcles.
Absolutely right. Two marks. He was a slave, Androcles, and a tailor, I think. And he did meet this lion, was very sorry for himself indeed, and pulled out this thorn from his paw. And the lion was a great pal afterwards. And then when he met him in the arena, Androcles was terribly frightened and sank down on his knees and prayed. But the lion just came up and sniffed him and then embraced him. And the emperor, who was watching this, was so astounded at what had happened that he set Androcles, the slave, free and gave him the lion for a pet. And Scott James, whose mother sent him dressed as a girl to the court of Lycomedes, and why did she do so?
Achilles?
Yes.
Thetis's mother sent Achilles to get him out of the war, a very shabby thing to do.
You're absolutely right. Thetis was Achilles' mother, and she tried very hard to make him immortal and been frustrated by her husband, and therefore she knew that he was likely to get killed through prophecy of his death in the Trojan War, and sent him away as a woman to the royal court in Scaros. But Odysseus was too smart and went there and discovered him by putting in front of him all the women of the court a lot of nice female jewellery on the one side and a sword and a shield on the other, and then caused a bugle to be blown off in the background as though a war was about to start, and the silly Achilles, in his woman's clothing, instead of picking up his jewellery, picked up the spear and the shield, and that discovered him.
I bet they made him an officer as well.
He showed OLQ, yes. Now, Banknell, who was Asclepius, and how did he die?
And how did he spell himself?
Well, if you'd like, prefer to call him Aesculapius, I wouldn't
mind. Oh, that's better. Ah, yes. Aesculapius, I don't know who the other one was, but Aesculapius was the man who supplied the rollocks to Charon for rowing those people across that dreary old river Styx. Medicine?
Yes.
Medicine?
Yes.
Ah, there we are. Two marks. He gathered herbs and medicine was, he was a kind of...
I want to know how he died.
His name seemed to connect with me with slow bicycle racing, but it's a blind alley.
No, I don't think so. He was the Greek god of medicine, and his healing powers are so great that he got a bit above himself and began to raise men from the dead. And Zeus, the chief of the gods, thought that he might teach mortals to be immortal, and this was obviously not to be allowed at all. And so he killed Asclepius with a thunderbolt, which was the weapon he used. That's the way he died. On our round of origins and derivations, and three marks the maximum possible, if members of the team can define the present meaning and then give me the origin of these words or expressions or phrases. Dillis Powell again. Music hath charms.
To soothe the savage ear. It means that music is a great soother and tranquilizer.
Yeah.
You don't need tranquilizing pills if you have it. And it comes from Congreve.
Yes. It means, as Dilly says, music can soothe and mollify you when you're in an angry or a nasty mood. In Congreve's play, The Mourning Bride, the opening lines are, "Music has charms to soothe a savage breast, to soften rocks or bend a knotted oak." And the reference is, of course, to Orpheus, who could do all sorts of things like that with his magic lute. Henry VIII, there's another song, "Orpheus with his lute made trees and the mountaintops that freeze bow themselves when he did sing." Same idea. Dennis Norton, what is a Ouija board and why was it so called? O-U-I-J-A. Ouija or Ouija?
Well, I don't know, it's better when you're tight, I can tell you. It seems to work, but you put the letters of the alphabet round in a circle and you put an upended tumbler in the middle, and then you all lay your forefingers on the tumbler and the tumbler moves to one of the letters, and it's supposed to be people who have passed over to the other side But I'm not sure about it myself. I think there was somebody who pushes.
And why call that?
Wee jar. Well, because they didn't used to do it with a tumbler. They used to do it with a wee jar. Push it. That's why. And then they couldn't sell it that way, so they gave it this rather kooky spelling.
I think of an Indian mystic called Weejar.
Yeah.
I gave it the alternative pronunciation because it really does rather help.
Oh, yes, yes. It's known as a yes, yes.
That's it. Spiritualists and others use this allegedly for receiving spirit messages. Usually you had a pointer of wood on wheels, and that was on a board where the letters of the alphabet and one to other signs were printed. And you put your finger on this and it moved or wheeled towards the letter which gave you the clue.
Planchette.
It's a planchette is the other word for it.
Right.
And the name comes from these two quite simple French and German words, oui and ja, both of them meaning yes, and the two put together make the oui ja board. Now, Anne Scott James, what is a melodrama and how did it get its name?
Well, it's a sort of purple passagey kind of play.
Mm-hmm. What happens in it?
Oh, it's tremendous murders and gore and rather crude love, hate, etc.
What happens at the end?
What happens at the end?
Virtue triumphs.
Yes.
Yeah. The curtain comes down.
That's right. That's it. That's what I wanted. That's what it is now. How do you get its name?
Milos. Yeah. Milos. In fact, bridge music in a play is still known as the Milos.
Yes. You haven't quite got that, but you very nearly have. As Anne rightly says, it nowadays means a thoroughly sensational play in which people tend to overact, and it ends always with virtue triumphant and the villain foiled or dead. But originally, it meant what it says. That is, it's a play and music put together. Song and music were introduced and an orchestra and made a background to the words. And at that stage, it didn't mean one of these sensational dramas at all. But various composers, including Beethoven and Mendelssohn, did in fact write melodramas in the old sense of the word. Frank Muir, what is a maroon, the one associated with bangers, and why is it so called a maroon?
Well, it's let off as a large firework to warn ships at sea or something in fog.
Mm-hmm.
And it's called a maroon. You can't call it a toffee apple or a tram car. It's a maroon. It's his name.
It had a reason for being called that. Put it into French.
Chestnut.
Yes, now explain.
Well, it's
Oh.
If you get a whole lot of chestnuts,
yes,
and put some gunpowder at the bottom and stuff them all into an old firework case and light it.
Simpler than that.
The chestnuts get hot and they explode.
They explode, yes.
And what are you doing with the chestnut when it does that?
Roasting it.
Yes.
Roast
chestnut blows up.
You crept home.
Damn silly reason for calling it.
Two, I think, because I did give quite a lot of help. It's a firework which explodes with a very loud bang, as Frank says, usually as a warning, or it could be at the start of a fiesta or something of that kind. And it does simply come from the French word marron, meaning a chestnut. And if you roast chestnuts in a particular way, they sometimes pop and explode. And that's why it was called this. Next round is the who, why, and what department. 2 marks for correct answers. Dennis Powell, who described what as a hateful tax levied upon commodities?
A hateful tax?
You ask your partner.
Tea.
No. Who did it and what was it?
It wasn't tea. It wasn't tea.
18th century.
Yeah.
Probably imposed by Walpole.
I think it probably was.
Oh. But it probably doesn't help us, that's what you mean. It
doesn't help very much. The comment was made a little later than that.
It was made by Dr. Johnson.
Quite right. And it's his definition of excise duty, a hateful tax levied upon commodities. A jolly good definition, too. Now, Dennis Norden, who said in what work, it isn't etiquette to cut anyone you've been introduced to, remove the joint?
I don't know, do you know?
Must be Alice, mightn't it?
Yeah. Is it one of the Queens?
Queens, yes, it must be, yes.
Mm. In? Which one?
Be Through the Looking Glass.
Yes, quite right. I think that's good enough, too. It's The Red Queen to Alice in Through the Looking Glass by Lewis Carroll. It isn't etiquette to cut anyone you've been introduced to. Remove the joint, and a little later with an execrable pun, she says, undishcover the fish or dishcover the riddle. It goes on like that for quite a long time. 2 marks. Anne Scott James, who in what book by whom said, 3 things I never lends, my os, my wife, and my name.
Jorrocks.
Yes. Author?
Assertees.
Yes. 2 marks. Mr. Jorrocks in Hillingdon Hall by R.S. Surtees was being asked by a lady to lend her his horse. And these were the 3 things he never lent: his os, his wife, and his name. Frank Muir, who said in what connection, give me but one firm spot on which to stand, and I will move the earth?
It was Archimedes.
Quite right. And what was he referring to?
He was referring to the effect a fulcrum can have.
Yeah.
If you can get far enough away with your lever from the levering point, and somewhere firm to stand, but enough room to jump up and down, you can, in theory, move the earth.
Absolutely right. Well,
he later invented the screw for raising water, which seems a bit obscure, but there we are.
Archimedes' screw, yes, that's right. Mm. 2 marks. It's Archimedes, and it's his theory of the lever and the fulcrum. And as Frank says, theoretically, if you get far enough away and the lever is long enough and the fulcrum's in the right place, you can shift the earth. This was his discovery. And now we come to the last round and go back to those 2 quotations I gave the teams earlier in the programme. 2 marks to Miss Powell. Can you give me the origin of your quotation? The dawn comes up like thunder.
It's Kipling.
Mm-hmm. Rudyard Kipling, The Road to Mandalay. 2 marks, well done. Anne Scott James, the origin of your quotation, please, which was, where there's a will, there's a way.
I think it's anonymous, one of those fine old English proverbs.
It is a proverb, but it's quoted by George Herbert in Outlandish Proverbs in the 17th century. Where there's a will, there's a way. And now I shall ask Frank and Dennis to give me their explanations of how these quotations came into being. And on this occasion, the marks will go to whichever incredible explanation receives the longer applause from the audience here in the theatre. So back to Frank Muir. The dawn comes up like thunder.
I'll make you wait a bit, I think. I don't need the 2 points. Don't need the money. You see, I've got this pop group. You see, I've signed them up. They're signed up to me. And everything's going swimmingly now. And we're going to be in the money. I'm going to be a millionaire. When I say it's a pop group, it's actually 5 rather elderly ladies. You see, I've just been concerned with a television show. In this show, there are 5 middle-aged, charming ladies who are the music for the show, and they are a quintet, string quintet, violin, cello. And when they left, I said, would you like to come under my banner? I hadn't got a banner, you know, but it sounded a thing to say. Would you like me to manage you? So I signed them up to see for this contract. They get £12 a week and a pork pie. I realised afterwards I really hadn't got all that much of a bargain anyway, because all their instruments had warped. You see, part of this was due to the effect of the BBC cameramen's breath. You see, because they always have a couple of gins before the show, and they used to help the ladies with their instruments, and their breath blistered the varnish, you see. And also, they had nothing to wear. They only had their own clothes. These lovely clothes they had were supplied by the BBC on the show. I didn't know all this, and I didn't know what to do about it. I thought I must invest. You know, you've got to accumulate, you've got to expectorate. So I watched advertisements very carefully, all these little mail order advertisements. They advertised a complete set of string instruments, 5. I wrote off for those. And they had a set of continental ornamental combs. I thought, lovely, Spanish. You know, halfway there, half a crown each. Sent off my PO, box number, you know. And they even sent off an amplifier, so that Miss Cloyes herself could sing if necessary, and everybody could hear clearly. Then, unfortunately, the stuff all came in, and it really wasn't quite what I expected. You see, the 5 stringed instruments were actually Irish harps. So I had my 5 ladies with 5 Irish harps. My amplifier turned out not to be an ordinary microphone, but to be an amplifier for guitars, to be plugged into electric guitars. And worst of all, my ornamental continental combs were ornamental continental comms. There was, of course, no way of telling from the spelling. So they were Albanian comms, used worn on festival occasions by the peasantry and in a vile state of repair. They were all torn and rent. Well, now, was I to give up or was I to press on? It's a question of ingenuity coming to the fore. I told my five ladies to climb in to these wretched comms, torn though they were. I said, that's your gimmick. All this sort of quasi-military gear they're wearing now. You're all like that, and that's what I'll call you. The Torn Combinations. TC. Then I will wire up your soft Irish harps into the amplifier to make an electronic sound. So any of you want a great pop group for your village hall or for your function, use mine. You want a big sound, everybody wants a big elemental sound. Well, they'll give it to you. The Torn Combs harp like thunder.
And now we go on to Dennis Norton. And if you remember, his quotation was, where there's a will, there's a way.
When it became apparent that the only career open to me was the entertainment profession, and there I'm quoting my Latin master's exact word, I went along to a big cinema in Leicester Square, and I said to the manager, look, I want a job here, I'm prepared to do anything, I don't care how humble the capacity, anything you have to offer, I'll do the job. And he was so impressed that he gave me a job as ice cream girl. I didn't last at it very long for health reasons. I'm a rather tall bloke, and the strap that goes around your shoulder on the thing was rather short, so that the tray came so high up on my chest I kept getting the straws from the orange drink up my nose. And I could very well have developed a nasty condition. But I explained this to him, and he moved me on to being the chap in charge of the cinema sign. That is to say, I had to put up those large cut-out letters which tell you the name of the film that's playing at the time. And I used to stand outside and watch the people passing and think, if it wasn't for me, they wouldn't know the name of the film that's on at this cinema. Actually, in the beginning, they didn't know the name of the film that was on at the cinema, because those letters are awfully big, you know, they're about 4 foot high, and you have to hump them up this ladder in a high wind, and sometimes you get them in the wrong order, you know. I remember there was Sean Connery in Glodfinger. But the worst mistake, actually, was not my fault at all. I was actually home in bed, and I got this call at 3 o'clock in the morning from the manager, and he said, your Y has dropped off. We were showing My Fair Lady at the time, and I realized that the Y, well, you know, I immediately rushed out of bed, as who wouldn't, because however permissive the moral climate that we are enjoying at the moment, it is just not on to give the impression that you're showing a film called My Fair Lad. And I got there about 4 o'clock in the morning. Sure enough, there was this large letter Y shattered on the pavement. I had to replace it. And then I had an inspiration. At the cinema opposite, they were showing the film Moby Dick. Moby, you see? M-O-B-Y. Well, it was the work of a moment. You know, nobody about that time in the morning. Slip over there, shin up the sign, grab the letter Y, and come back, which I accomplished without any... Well, there was one nasty moment, actually, when a policeman noticed me carrying it. He said, excuse me, sir, may I ask what you're doing carrying that large letter Y with you this time of the morning? And I said, it isn't a letter Y, officer. I thought very quickly. I said, I'm a water diviner by profession. And I happened to use a very large twig. Well, it satisfied him. And in no time, I had that letter back up there. And sure enough, next day, our cinema was showing My Fair Lady on its sign. Mind you, the cinema opposite looked a bit weird, showing a film called Mob Dick, but that's show business. And ever since, I've had a rather warm feeling for Herman Melville's novel. And in fact, I would remind any sign putter-uppers who may be listening that if they're ever in the same trouble, remember my predicament, remember Moby Dick, remember that where there's a whale, there's a why.
Well, I couldn't see how Dennis was going to fight his way out of that one, but he did. And by your vote, nevertheless, Frank Muir wins the contest of the two stories. And that brings us to a final score in which Anne Scott James and Dennis win the entire contest by 2 marks. And it also brings to an end this edition of My Word.
In My Word, you heard Dilys Powell, Anne Scott James, Frank Muir, and Dennis Norden, introduced by Jack Longland. The program was devised by Tony Schryan and Edward J. Mason, and presented by the BBC.